Kof Aleph Adar Sheni, Sunday the 27th of March. This week's Torah Away has been sponsored by Family Shtimler, Lichvod Simchas HaNishuim, Shel Josh Morris and Michelle Shtimler. Rabbi Aaron Hirsch, the Noam Elimelech and the History of Hasidus.
So today obviously is possibly the old site of the Noam Elimelech. I mean, that's some quinter or more. It really should be Adar Aleph. But I'll leave that to those greater and better than me. There's a pasuk in the beginning of Bereishis which says, "V'nor yotze me'eden lehashkos es hagan, u'mishom yuparid v'hoya l'arbo roshim." And Reb Zusha used to fataych this pasuk as referring to the beginnings of Chassidus. That Eden was the Makor, in other words, the Baal Shem Tov. The Nahor was the Mezrich Magid. The Gan, which is then the recipient, is Noam Elimelech. And from there it went into four individuals. That is the Abtarov, the Koshnitzer Magid, Rav Nachman Mendel of Rimonov, and the Chayza. These were the four main Talmidim of the Noam Elimelech. There was also the Mor of Ashomesh. But these four were responsible for, in a greater way, the spread of Hasidus generally. Now, of course, there was more than just these seven individuals that made Hasidus happen. And there's more than the fact that these Gedolim happened to be around in the 1700s. That made Hasidus itself occur. Really, the origins go back to Tach V'Tat. 1648 was seen by many to be a time, an ace case, a time for Moshiach. The Shach wrote that I saw in this as Bezois Yovei Arein El HaKodesh, that I saw in this Bezois Gematria 408, as we know from Yom Kippur, that I thought that in this year, this would be the time that Mashiach would come. Shef Lahorovitz, the Shlosh's son, also wrote the same Signon, and Rav Naftali Katz. There were many that wrote about this time as being an auspicious moment, Pashal Astropola. But instead, the exact opposite happened. It was a time of absolute churban. And the churban had four outcomes. The first was Poshet Yush, that people gave up. They had seen this as being such a potential possibility, and the reverse happened. And it was coming on the heels of the last few hundred years of the blood libels and the exiles, and all of it brought together a tremendous sense of not knowing where to turn next. In addition, there was the ongoing poverty, grinding poverty, a poverty that meant that people had no time to think of anything else, in the same way as Shibud Mitzrayim. Paro decided the best way to keep them away from thoughts of Cheirus is Tichvad Aleihem es Avoda. In addition, anti-Semitism now was far more open. Poland, at least until then, had been a place relatively calm, relatively. But now there was a far greater open anti-Semitic manifestation, first of all, of Christianity, and second of all, generally, that the Jews were treated as negotiable property. At one stage, and still as late as 1740, there was an attempt to make the Jews literally into property, and that they could be sold from one poritz to another. The attempt failed in the parliament there, but the fact that it could come to parliament in the first place gives you an idea of the hashmola that the Jews were subject to at the time. And the fourth outcome was that as a result of the destruction of the yeshivas in Poland, the golden age of Jewry, if you look in, go to the Beis HaKoros in Krakow, you realize that for 100 years there was a golden age of Jewry. But after this time, Poland itself was virtually destroyed. The Torah in Poland was virtually destroyed by what happened in Tachbetat, and therefore education was, especially amongst the poor, very weak. Contemporary accounts write that people don't know what it means to have Matilas Yadayim before they eat. This is not something they're familiar with. And we have to understand the geographical picture of the Jews in those areas. We call it generically Poland, but of course borders change all the time, so, you know, the Ukraine, etc., it's all part of one chelek. But Jews are living, to a large degree, in isolation. Meaning, you could have 20 in a village, or 5 in a village, or 50 in a derfel somewhere. They weren't necessarily large concentrations of Jews. And therefore, they couldn't put together a kehillah life in the way we would be accustomed to it today. And you had also Jews running inns. They were completely on their own. And we know of all, you know, all the mises of people hiring melamdim, which came after, especially after the advent of Hasidus. But these Jews were living literally on their own. And that added to the sense of yush. The Gedolei Hador at the time, for one reason or another, were not able or up to the challenge that presented itself. And it needed a revolution in order to make something happen. And that's really what the Baal Shem Tov came to achieve. He was born in 1698, he died in 1760. He came to change the way the Hamoin Am lived in these areas. His goal was to save literally hundreds of thousands of Jews. And he was remarkably successful in what he attempted to do. But in being successful, he had to bring about a revolution. And you make an omelette, you're going to break some eggs. It's impossible to achieve the success that he did and for there to be no problems in its wake. Firstly, he was taking on the establishment, really by having to change the focus of people's lives. The way to do it, he saw, was by bypassing the normal methods of leadership in Klal Yisrael. The rov in town would, in effect, now be neglected or overlooked for the Rebbe. Because to the Rebbe, they would come from a wider geographical area, which meant that their own local rov would no longer have the standing that they had had until then. On the other hand, the local rov wasn't getting through, wasn't dealing with the problem. It was shas hadchak, it was pekuach nefesh. For these people, they would just drop off the edge. Secondly, in creating this movement, how much he would be aware of where it would go over the next century, 1.5 centuries, difficult to know. We have none of the Baal Shem Tov himself, of his things that he wrote himself. We have nothing besides for one letter. Of course, we have a lot of ksovim and a lot of and a lot of maises that were written by Talmidim. But of him himself, there's the letter that he wrote to his brother-in-law. That's, as far as I'm aware, the only thing we have written, so to speak, b'ksav yodai. But what it meant was that he was creating leaders who would then lead in their own way. Chassidus was never going to be monolithic. It was never going to be the case that there was going to be a form and a style and even a content of leadership where everybody would be the same as one another. Which meant that the internal direction of Hasidus, which direction the actual leaders of Hasidus would take it in, would not be singular. And therefore amongst themselves there would be dissent. It was inevitable. Because he wasn't creating a yeshiva, a particular produced product which would go in a particular direction, but rather an idea. Conceptually, he was bringing into being a method of getting through to the klal. But the facts on the ground would speak for themselves. And of course, there was the problem that this was being done in the aftermath of Shabbatai Tzvi, which is for another time, but in the outcome was that anybody who gets up and starts changing things, and his changes are based to a certain degree on Kabbalah, and it's a new direction which doesn't seem to have the Masorah behind it, well, this is ringing alarm bells. It sounds like a new Shabbatai Tzvi. The fact that it wouldn't be a new Shabbatai Tzvi would only be visible in the test of time. That they would only be able to see decades later, but not when it started. Having said that, the first Chayram that was pronounced was not during the lifetime of the Baal Shem, but during the very, very end of the life of the Mezrich Magid. So it actually appears that initially, for one reason or another, either because it wasn't as spread, or because the effects were not as pronounced, there was no Chayram ever spoken against the Baal Shem Tov, definitely not in publicly. And the third problem, the third issue that he had to deal with is how to actually create the message, so to speak, to use the wrong term, but how to get through to people. Because despite all the stories that we were brought up on as children, it's not the case that it was, you went to the Rebbe and everything worked out happily ever after. If you didn't have children or you didn't have a parnasa or whatever it was, you went in, you got bracha, you came out and everything was fine. That did not happen in the majority of cases. But what did happen is that there was a listening ear, that there was at least somebody to whom you could pour out your troubles. That's what the address of the Rebbe was, at least those Rebbes that addressed themselves much more to the general klal. So that there needed to be a message that could be put across which would give them the ability to survive in Golus. It would not be that I will now take you out of Golus, but rather something that gives you the ability to continue. And the emphasis of Hasidus, and of course I'm being very general in this and very broad, but the emphasis of in Hasidus was on the personal connection that a person can have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which then translates into the concept of tefillah, and in the concept of self-generated simcha. Meaning the outside world is not a place that you are going to find simcha. The outside world is Golus. But internally, you are the king of your own castle. And therefore on Shabbos Bifrat, there is an oasis which you will generate on your own. You have to find that simcha, but if you do, you will have something worth living for. And that your Asiyas HaMitzvahs will connect you to something far broader, far greater. The whole idea of the L'shem Yichud. What you're doing is your little action here is lighting up something across the world, across many worlds. And your personal connection is real, even if you are not the God Lador or the Rav in a shul, or in fact you can't even read. And there's you know, to put this into real context, the story of the shepherd boy who on Rosh Hashanah he can't even read and he can't daven, but he can say the Aleph Beis, and his saying of the Aleph Beis was greater than all the tefillahs that they said in Shtot. And it was necessary to put that across because these people had no other access to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, that was the way that they would be kept on board, and they were kept on board that way. But, of course, the other side of the message can very much be understood, so Torah doesn't matter. And people who are the leaders in Torah are not really that important, and everybody's equal. I mean, amongst the Hasidim, you're going to in Warsaw before the war, so everyone was, you know, on first-name terms. Even Gedolim, it was that there was a certain tzavtza that came out from Hasidus, which, of course, meant that it made things much more approachable, but it therefore attacked the concept that somebody who is the representative of Torah in the world has more of a standing. And it undermined the learning of Torah itself. But in a way, this was the only way to put the message over. Ironically, those things which we most relate to Hasidus today were not specific to Hasidus at all. The concept of language. Everyone spoke Yiddish. No matter who you were, you spoke Yiddish. You spoke Yiddish even, you know, into the 20th century, even if you were completely irreligious. So that wasn't a feature of it. Nor was dress a particular feature, because more or less the methods of dress were common to Jews in Eastern Europe. So those things which we most identify were not specific to what the Baal Shem Tov and his Talmidim and their Talmidim brought into being. Now, the legend that was created around the Baal Shem Tov, of course, made him larger than life. There's a three-volume set, it's called Teres HaChassidus, which goes through the genealogy, the Doris, and in the introduction he writes that Ein shevach sheloi nishtabach boi habesht. Basically, there's no praise which the Besh was not attributed to the Baal Shem Tov. And the concept of the story of Sipurei Hasidim became very central to the putting over of the message. But in the process, things got out of hand in describing these people, that it virtually became that these people are a throwback to the Tanaim and Amoraim. That, we've skipped over, never mind the Rishonim, we've gone all the way back in time by 1,000 years, and there's nothing they can't do. It could be B'chai Mesim, whatever it is that you want, they are able to do. Now, of course, when this comes to the establishment, it's looked at with horror on many fronts. Once again, we'll deal with that maybe for a future occasion, deal with the machlokes. But we can understand how it was viewed, either with suspicion or in a very negative way. Now, the leadership who took up the mantle of Hasidus from the Baal Shem Tov's time onwards, it did not pass from father to son. That really, although you do have dynasties, so to speak, that do start already in the late 1700s, really that's more of a concept for the 1800s. But generally speaking, the 1700s, the people who took over were the people who were the most able, who were the most worthy. And even that itself was subject to debate. In even the second generation, we talk of the Mezritch Maggid as leading it, but Pinchas of Koritz really wanted that the person who took over should be Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the author of the Toldos, the first major Hasidic, you could say, philosophy that was written. He wanted him to take over because he felt that the Mezritch Maggid, living in one town, being in one place and not travelling in the way that the Baal Shem Tov did was contrary to the whole idea of Hasidus. So there was a machlokes going on there, and that there were in each successive generation there would be differences as to how exactly to carry out the idea of the Baal Shem Tov. The leaders, however, were of the young and the brightest and the best, and of course they came mostly from what we would call Litvisher backgrounds, although the whole concept and the terminology only came about later. But they were people who were converted, right? They had come from the standard Torah way of life, and they became revolutionaries. But they were revolutionaries who knew the world that they had come from, understood it, and fought against it. And they were, in the main, tremendous Talmidei Chachamim in their own right. It wasn't the age where anybody, set themselves up as a leader. These people had to be able to prove their point, because there was no natural inheritance of the position. You had to be somebody who was Negea. Now, the Noam HaMelech himself had similar origins. He was born in 1717. He was born near Tiktin in a little village called Lupakhova, which nowadays is the forest around there is a place where there's a mass cave, unfortunately, from the war. The shul in Tiktin is still there. It's a shul that goes back to the 1500s. The Marshal was the Rav there. The Magen Shlomo was the Rav there. And it was well known. The area was well known as a place of Torah. His father was quite wealthy, and Reb Zusha, Noam HaMelech's older brother, writes about their mother that she didn't daven from a siddur because she couldn't read. But the hislavus with which she said brochus in the morning was such that he said the Shechinah resided in that place after she'd left it. So we're talking about a sort of a classic definition of that which was needed. People who couldn't read but could nevertheless be brought to places of Dveikus. The two brothers were originally taught by Reb Shmuel Kohorovitz, who would then go to Nikolsburg, who was in that area, and also by Shmuelka's brother, the Haflor of Pinchas. And they then both went into Golus for a number of years, ended up in Shilva. They came under the influence of Hasidus of the Baal Shem Tov originally, and then the Meseritsha Magid. And when the Meseritsha Magid died in 1773, 13 years after the Baal Shem Tov, Noam HaMelech went to Lizhensk, which is where he stayed for the rest of his life. Now, when the rest of his life ended is also subject to debate. Was it 1786 or 1787? The Matseva says one thing and other people say another. Not quite sure. It's one of those 2 years. The first time the Noam HaMelech itself was printed was either way after he had died. It was printed in Lvov and Lemberg in 1788. So it's either a year or 2 years after he died. Now, Lizhensk was, like many towns in Poland, a small place where there had been Yidden for a couple of hundred years. The first mention we have of Jews living there is in 1521. By 1633, there was already a street on which Jews lived, which means there were a number of Jews living there. And in the Beis HaKvaros, where the Noam HaMelech is, so of course during the war the Nazis destroyed most of the Beis HaKvaros, but before the war there were Matzevus in that Beis HaKvaros that still dated back to the late 1600s. So there was what we would call a Kehillah definitely in the 1600s. Just before the Noam HaMelech came, we have a census of there being 900 Yidden living in Lizhensk. By 1880, out of 5,000 people in town, 2,000 were Jewish. And before the war, out of 5,000, 3,000 were Jewish. So it was a small place with a high percentage of Yidden living there. The Noam Elimelech also, to a large degree, took on the approach of the Mezrich Magid, which is that he was in one place and people came to him. But it was during his lifetime, and to a large degree under his leadership, that Poland became Hasidish. Originally it had been in the Ukraine and northern Romania. Those were the areas where the Baal Shem Tov had started out and most of the Talmidim. But in the times of the Noam Elimelech, Poland was conquered by Hasidus. And therefore the Cherem, which we still have, the original, the Cherem that was read out in Krakow against Hasidus, was read out in 1786, which is either just after or at the very end of the Noam Elimelech's life, because that's when it had become successful. It was real enough that the establishment wanted to do something about it in Poland, not just in Lithuania. And the approach of Noam Elimelech was to create, as many others did, was to create two different types of derech. There was the inner circle, those people who lived in the chotzer of the Rebbe, who lived there for years on end, and they were the real Talmidim. They were the people who would become the leaders of the next Dor. And then there was the Hamoinam, the people who came in because they needed somewhere to go to. And he lived during the time of the real machlokes between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. In many of the printings of Noam Elimelech, you have two of the letters that he wrote, one of which justifies the use of Nusach Ari. And he, like the Mezrich Magid, generally took the approach of not responding in a warlike fashion, because it would only add fuel to the flames. Except when it came to the defence of certain Gdolim, the Bedichshava in particular. But generally speaking, his approach was, we will, anan bedidon, we will do what we need to do, and eventually the MS will make itself apparent. Now, the town of Lizhensk was, at the time, centrally in Galicia. Galicia is the bottom half of Poland that goes quite a lot into what is nowadays the Ukraine. And Reb Tzvi Hirschmeisels, who was a Rav in the 20th century before the war and went through Auschwitz and wrote a Sefer Mekadshei Hashem after the war. In the Hakdama to Mekadshei Hashem, he talks about many things. He talks about some of what happened to him and to people in Auschwitz. But he also writes, he says, when I came to Auschwitz-Birkenau, I understood that this is the famous or infamous place where it is said in Hasidus that the two brothers, Reb Zusha and Reb Elimelech, were trying to overcome the Baal Dovor and spread Hasidus far and wide, and they were stopped in a particular place. Right? And I understood that this is how far they got to. And in fact, Galicia of old, Auschwitz, was literally on the border of Galicia. So that's how far they got. That's they got no further. Now, the Noam Elimelech, the Sefer, was called Noam Elimelech. There are various reasons given. His son, who took over as the Rebbe from the Noam Elimelech, writes it's based on the concept of ni'ima, of something which is sweet. But others say that it is in hakara to his brother, Rabzusha, right, which also means ni'ima, which also means sweet. That's why it was named such. There is a Masera given by Reb Rafael David Erbach, brother of Reb Shlomo Zalman, who says that he heard from his father, Reb Chaim Leib Erbach, the following. Reb Chaim Leib said that when he was living in Eretz Yisrael, in the Old City, when the English were still in control of Eretz Yisrael, he used to daven in the Old City, he used to daven in a Chabad shul there. And there was an old Jew there who used to stoke up the oven, used to put wood into the oven, keep the oven burning. And this old person said that his father used to go to the Noam Elimelech for Shabbosos. And when it came to Shal Shudas, so the Noam Elimelech, after he had spoken Torah, would speak about the Zman of Mashiach. And he said over a number of things, but this person could only remember three of them. Three things that he had heard from his father. One of them was that Bizman Mashiach, those people who are the Yirei Shamayim, they will be put in such a matzav of hashpala that were this to have happened to those tzaddikim in the times of Baal Shem Tov, they would never have been able to be sovelit. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring into the world neshamas that are more megushim, that are therefore able to take this tsar, which earlier neshamas would not have been able to take. Then he said, there will be a rope that will extend from one end of the world to the other, which we will hold on to. And during the Chevle Moshiach, and he translated Chevle as related to the Chevel, to this rope, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will shake this rope so strongly that most people won't be holding on at the end of it. That's the golus that we will go through. And the way that he put it is that the Shaitim will say, clearly HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us if he has tried to get rid of us so strongly. And only those who hold on to the rope, to hold on to their emunah, they will come through. And then he said at the very end there will be like a sieve, where the fine flour will fall through, and the coarse, that which you throw out, will stay in the sieve. And they will be, the ones that will fall through will be the tzaddikim, the Yirei Shamayim, and the ones that stay in the sieve will be the people who are not part of Torah. And they will look down at the others and say, we survived and you didn't. But it will only be for a moment, because they will then all be jettisoned, and those, the flower that came through, that will be held on to. Those are the three teachings that come across from the Baal Shem Tov. I've now run out of time, but briefly, one more minute, just to say that there's no question about the fact that in terms of the revolutions that rocked the Jewish world in the 19th century, that Hasidus was more effective at preventing the descent than the Jews in Western Europe, or than the Litvisher Jews. Of course, the success that they have in the 19th century, in a way, is some of the problem in the 21st century, because when something worked once, that doesn't mean it also will work 200 years later. So that in itself is part of the challenge. The success is sometimes part of the challenge. And one last thing, and that is, if you go to Luzhensk, not during Adar, but at other times of the year, as I have occasion to do, you'll be able, besides to see the Achnas Seirchem and the Mikveh and the Kvarim there, you'll also be able to see a throwback to the olden days of Poland, because the Goy who's got the keys to the Achnas Seirchem and the Beis HaKvaris is a dyed-in-the-wool anti-Semite of old. I was there at one stage with a chav of mine, Rabbi Johnny Ross, and this Henry, that's his name, who's saying to him, he said, listen, if only one nation hated the Yidden, you could blame the nation. But since all the nations of the world hate the Yidden, it must be the fault of the Jews. So you can get the authentic experience of going to Poland in more ways than one. But of course, the ikka that we have from the Noam Elimelech are his svarim, especially the tefillahs that he made, and it's worth, especially today, having a look at that tefillah, because there's no one to whom it isn't relevant, and we should be zeicha through this to the Geula Shleima.